Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Andrew Hobbs about his examination of the provincial press in Victorian England, entitled A Fleet Street in Every Town, The Provincial Press in England, 1855 to 1900. Andrew, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Mark.
Well, it's good to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
So I'm a senior lecturer at a university in the northwest of England, the University of Central Lancashire, and my research is about the history of journalism, particularly the history of local newspapers in the 19th century.
It's a very interesting topic, and one of the things I enjoyed about your book was you show the many ways in which it was just such a fascinating subject. And I especially like the fact that you're going about it both as a study of these newspapers as historical artifacts, but also you're studying so much more. You're studying their audience, you're studying their production. What was it that led you to choose this as a topic?
It goes back a long way, really. It's kind of my grudge against the centralized London London media in Britain. It's very different than the States. Everything is centered on London. And I'm an ex-journalist myself, so when I started my career in the 1980s, really, to get ahead, you had to work in London for a while. And I just really resented that. And I think I've sort of, after decades, I kind of found my way to the history of newspapers in the 19th century and found a time when the British media wasn't so centralized, and that the map, not everything, not all the lines went to London, but there were lots of little local centers dotted all around the map, producing very high quality journalism, and often in advance of developments in London. So it was kind of working out my grudge against London.
It was for me a fascinating way to approach it, because I keep thinking about something I read in another book about which sort of denigrated provincial journalism as, you know, somebody comes in and you ask the editor at this local newspaper somewhere, you know, what it is they're going to be writing about, and he basically, I remember the quote goes that he pulls a London paper down and circles a column and then writes at the bottom, what do you think about this? And it really does reflect that bias that, as you explain in your book, I think quite effectively, it is just so unfair and distorting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that did go on. There was scissors and paste journalism, as it was called. But it happened as much with the London papers cutting bits out of regional local papers from the other parts of Britain as the other way around. And if you had some kind of heat map of Victorian Britain that picked up, you know, where news was moving from and to, it wasn't just going out from, radiating out from London. It was going in the opposite direction equally, and it was going quite, you know, far away from London, from say between Manchester and Leeds, or between Dublin and Edinburgh and Birmingham and Bristol. And London was often cut out of these circuits as much as it was included. So, yeah, it's very much these were little local centres that in a kind of narrow-minded provincial way, you might say, they saw themselves as a centre of their worlds, their little towns, their small cities. But in some ways, that was true. The country was a much less centralised state than it is now, both culturally and politically. And so, you know, people, educated people, professionals, they would get their news from a local or a regional paper first because it was tailored to their needs, what even their professional needs. The Manchester Guardian could serve those needs better than the London Times could, for example.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us a little something about what the Victorian press was like, specifically the provincial press back then, because as you demonstrate, it's a very different media experience than what people today might be familiar with, even outside of the internet, in terms of, as you describe, you know, this central hubris of the London press, which simply wasn't there back then, because as you're describing, it's a very different media environment. It's a very different social environment. What was that environment like back then? And how is this reflected in the press?
At the start of the time that I'm looking at, which is about the middle of the 19th century, then it was reasonably easy with a few hundred pounds and a printer that trusted that you'd pay your bills. You could set up a little weekly local newspaper with very little capital. And so that it meant it's quite an open, free business environment, people coming in, going bust and moving out again. But people with good ideas and ability really having room to take off. And these newspapers were very different than they are today. We think, all right, a local newspaper, that's all about local news. But that was only a small part of what they contained. They had national news. They had international news. They produced a lot of their own features. They published history, poetry. They were more a mixture of magazine and newspaper rather than just sort of more straightforwardly news content that you might get today. But they wouldn't have huge staffs, maybe one or two reporters on these small local weeklies. But they would have quite a lot of people writing for them that weren't on the staff, just amateurs, experts in all sorts of obscure subjects. That there might be an expert on the use of a particular type of cow dung, or they might be an amateur local historian, or they might be perhaps the local corn merchant who went to the nearest regional corn market every day and he would bring back just reports of prices and drop them off at the newspaper office. So they could call on quite a lot of local and regional experts beyond their staff. So they really were, you know, keenly read by everyone in the area. And even if you couldn't read, people would hear them read out loud to them.
There's another aspect in your study that you plays a role in all this, which is just how much this environment is changing. I mean, 1855, you're talking about the end of the so-called knowledge taxes, but you're also talking about a time at which the audience or the consumer base, if you will, of newspapers is rapidly growing in ways that that really define or redefine what newspapers were back then.
Yes, so yeah, in all sorts of ways, literacy was on a very, very steep upward curve. More and more people were getting educated, but one of the things that fascinated me was that whether or not you could read was not a barrier to be able to get the news and to be able to hear the newspaper. So I give the example of pubs, you know, bars, where the landlord would actually pay someone to read the paper on the evening of the day it came out, usually a Saturday. And they would find someone that had a good dramatic reading voice that could, as I think a Dickens character says, he can do the police in different voices. So if they're reading out a court case, that, you know, they could distinguish between the policeman giving evidence, the magistrate, the defendant, the witnesses, and bring that story alive in the pub and everyone would be sat around listening to the news. And so, literacy or illiteracy wasn't particularly significant. I think what really did change in the second half of the 19th century was that it went from not many people buying a newspaper, that they might go to a public reading room or a newsroom to read it, or they might go to the pub to hear it read, or they might hear it read in the workshop sometimes. But increasingly, as prices dropped, and as you said, the taxes were taken off newspapers, and it all became cheaper and cheaper, people could start to buy their own newspapers, and publishers realized that there was money to be made out of working class newspaper readers, which was a pretty new idea. And things like the halfpenny evening newspaper, and even the halfpenny morning paper and the penny weekly paper. We were way behind the States. I know you had your penny press in the early 1800s. It took us about another 50 or 60 years. But when publishers realized that here was this massive untapped market of people that would buy a paper rather than just eavesdropping on what was being written for other types of readers, then they started targeting their papers at that working class public and also at women and even at children. And it produced a lot of different types of newspapers and more varied, more interesting papers, really.
Given the scope of your project, it strikes me as one that could be so enormously overwhelming. And what you do in the book is you focus upon, while not ignoring the provincial press generally, you focus on one example. And I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us a bit about Preston and what it was like as a market and what were the newspapers that were in Preston during this time.
Okay, so yeah, some of your listeners may not have heard of Preston in Lancashire. Hard to believe for myself. I've spent most of my life here. It's nowadays we're proud that it was the first place in the UK to get a Kentucky Fried Chicken shop, even before London. It's got the biggest bus station in Europe. I mean, I could go on and on. But back then, I mean, Karl Marx, for one, in fact, I opened the book in this way, he thought world revolution was going to begin in Preston because there was this very famous strike of, well, it's actually a lockout by the mill owners in the 1850s, and Dickens and Elizabeth Gaskell and other people wrote about this. And Marx was very interested in it as well. So it was a cotton town, spinning and weaving, also had sort of ancillary industries. It was an old regional headquarters, so it had a lot of law courts, it had sort of regional administration. So it had a mixed economy. It wasn't just a working class town. And it was kind of the third centre of Lancashire. So there was Manchester in the southeast of the county, there was Liverpool on the coast to the west. And then north of those two was Preston, kind of the third most significant urban area. And it was on lots of transport routes. So it was kind of the obvious third newspaper centre for that area. And at that time, Lancashire, which had been in the lead of the Industrial Revolution, was therefore pretty highly populated, quite a densely populated area. So there were lots of potential customers. And towns were pretty close together, sort of 10 miles between a town, even 5 miles, but they were quite distinctive. I mean, it's still the case today. You can just travel 10 miles between one town or another in all around England, but especially in this part of the country, and the accent is completely different, the economy is different, the culture is different, the way people even dress and look is different, and that's true today and was probably even more so then. So although densely populated, still lots of distinct little local cultures, which was, you know, perfect for a media industry, which I argue that they made money out of selling people's local identities and people's local patriotism, selling that back to them through the local press.
So you have this, you know, as you're describing this, very diverse market, lots of, and at the same time, it's also a very concentrated one geographically, or at least it can be under the right circumstances. So who were the readers that you're talking about? Who was the audience for the newspapers? What were they like? You mentioned that you're talking about a diverse audience. Did somebody try to cater to the entire audience, or was it more of a, or were these newspapers generally targeted towards specific groups?
When newspapers were still expensive in the first half of the 19th century, they were targeted at middle-class people, really, and upper-class people. It would cost you, it would cost a workman perhaps a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours, to earn the money to pay for a newspaper. Today that would be, dollars, but like, $30 or $40 potentially. To get the price of a newspaper. So out of the reach of most working class people. But then as prices came down, they did start to broaden it out. Some papers did try and reach all targets, particularly some of these weekly newspapers. I mean, the focus in a lot of journalism history has been on the daily papers because somehow, they're kind of more exciting and the idea of speed and interesting. But when you actually look at what most people read, it was these humdrum local weekly papers. And they would try and have something for everyone. So they would have a women's column. They would have even a children's corner. They would have, towards the end of the century, they'd have columns about trade union news, church news, gardening notes, all these sort of magazine-y type features. But also some publishers thought, well, there's more money to be made by segmenting the market. So we'll have a halfpenny evening paper full of sports news, racing news, football news, and just the latest sort of breaking news for workers coming out of the factory gate at 6 o'clock at night. Then we'll have the traditional weekly, which we'll try and keep attractive to the middle class readers. And then we'll have a morning daily for the professionals that want to sort of their own local version of the London Times, really. Stock market prices and Manchester cotton prices and all the latest Liverpool shipping news. So some publishers segmented the market, whilst others tried to be something for everyone.
One of the things that you go into detail about in the book that I thought was especially interesting was this notion of where they read. And you focus upon something that nowadays a lot of people tend to ignore when they're in a community and they see these places, which are these reading rooms. We're familiar with libraries, and you can go to any library today and see people who are reading the newspapers and magazines there. But this was not just a matter of a public supported institution or a charitable supported institution, but you're talking about these smaller places where people went, especially during that critical time that you describe, when they're going from being unable to afford a newspaper to where they start to become subscribers themselves. What were these places like, and how did they change during this period that you're focusing on?
Yeah, I mean, I found this absolutely fascinating because we just think of newspaper reading as being an individual silent reading activity, maybe when you're commuting or maybe when you're at home. But to actually sort of go out of the house, and there's the diaries of a weaver called John Neal from a small town near Preston. And he's great evidence because he was so boring that he wrote about reading the local newspaper. and that's absolute gold for a historian like me. But every Saturday night, he would walk a couple of miles into the nearest town to a pub that carried newspapers. So he would read those in a pub. In his village, they did actually have a little mechanics institute, like a sort of adult education night school that had its own newspaper reading room. So some of them, they were just rented rooms, just any old room that could be rented cheaply. And some of the working class reading rooms, they would charge you a penny a day, or you might which would be kind of be affordable, because the more middle class reading rooms, it might be, you know, one or two guineas per year, but they'd expect you to cough that up at the beginning of the year, and obviously that big lump sum was out of the reach of a lot of working class people. So some of them were just, there were commercial concerns, or just kind of a group of people clubbing together, perhaps through their local church or through the local Mechanics Institute. Hey, you know, let's get a newsroom going. And they'd often start these newsrooms during a particularly exciting war. So perhaps the Crimean War, perhaps the American Civil War. You can see a sort of uptick in the number of newsrooms that open. Sometimes churches would offer them. Political parties in the 1860s, for the first time, a certain number of working class people got the vote, and political parties were anxious to get them over to their side. So they'd lure them into the party by having a newsroom, a reading room, as part of their political club. And then towards the end of the century, public libraries, publicly funded libraries, began to take off. And having newspapers and magazines there was a massive attraction. In fact, it seemed to be that when these public libraries opened, it was the newspaper reading rooms that were more of an attraction than the books, the novels and so on. So a whole range, and then things like the retail cooperative movement, these sort of people clubbing together to sort of avoid being ripped off by other shopkeepers or being cheated with, you know, chalk dust in their flour, set up these retail cooperative shops that then also had newspaper reading rooms, often in a room above the shop. And that was a very popular working class cultural movement, as well as a shopping movement as well. And they were a big place to go to read the paper.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So what you describe here is both a surprisingly wide audience, a growing audience, and at the same time a very diverse audience. Yet you focus upon more than just the audience for these newspapers. You also describe how they were produced and who produced them. And your case study, I thought was very interesting. And I was wondering if you could perhaps, perhaps speak a little generally as to how newspapers were produced back then, and then talk about this Preston reporter / editor who really, you know, I thought so nicely encapsulated the changes that are taking place during this period.
Yeah, so I mean, I chose Preston as a case study because this is where I'm based, and I know that there's good archives and a sort of an interesting history of papers. But I've also, what I've tried to do is try and look at the local press as a national phenomenon, which kind of blows people's minds in a way. But if you think that the national is made up of lots of locals, then it's not such a weird idea, really. So I have looked at the whole national map of local papers all around the country, and the same trends come up in other places as they do in this case study town of Preston. So yeah, I sort of went into some depth just to see what can come out by really going into local depth. And luckily enough, again, yeah, Preston is a good case study because there are these diaries of this journalist that you mentioned, Anthony Hewitson, who started as a printer's apprentice at the age of 14 and then became a newspaper reporter. He taught himself shorthand and then he got some money and bought a small local paper in Preston and then bought papers elsewhere. And luckily for us, he wrote a diary from fairly early on in his reporting career. And strangely enough, it's the only diary that I know of an English provincial journalist. There's only maybe three or four diaries of journalists that worked in London, but no others that I know of, and no one else has come up with any for the 19th century from the local newspaper world. So it's great stuff. And his diaries just show this national networked, decentralized nature of the local press. He's always got an eye for the main chance. So whenever he comes across a good story like a train crash, he thinks, right, I can sell that to papers in Sheffield and Manchester and Glasgow and London. And so he's sending off telegrams and sort of carbon copies of his report. And in fact, he admits sometimes he spends more time on his sort of secret freelancing career than on what he's actually paid to do by his employer as a staff reporter. And I think that's eventually the reason why he gets sacked, to be honest. But he does write about the sort of the mechanics of reporting and editing and the social networks. If there's a big story in Preston, then reporters come from other parts of the country and he'll go out for a drink with them and they'll sort of, you know, network professionally. And you get a sense of the speed and the distance that you might cover either by walking or by horse and cart or sometimes by train. Just getting around the north of Lancashire to get the stories. And then working late into the night to get the paper to press. And it is, I mean, the diary is fantastic because he goes from, yeah, being a reporter on quite a big sort of radical liberal newspaper to having his own paper. And his politics change and his theology changes. And as an editor, he has sort of labour troubles. The printers want a pay rise, so he sacks them all and employs non-union labour instead. So there's all sorts of insights. And when you start following up some of these little bare one-sentence diary entries, you stumble across whole other stories that shed so much light on the way that the press worked. And you can connect. I mean, in the book, I take one of these stories that he reports of quite a big train crash outside Preston, and he says that he's writing this for other newspapers. And we're lucky nowadays that so many Victorian newspapers have been digitized, so you can sort of very quickly search for a particular story and follow how this kind of ripples out from Preston. You know, it sends a copy off to the Times, so it's in the Times the next morning, and some of the other big city papers around the country. And then the smaller weeklies follow it up, and then a news agency gets involved and sort of takes a story off him. And then it sort of spreads again, the second wave. And you can, like I say, I don't know, I mean, perhaps I need to work with some computer visualization expert. But again, if you have this sort of heat map or some way of watching this train crash story just spread out from Preston on some sort of electronic map of Victorian Britain, I've tried to get a sense of that, of how the news moved and how quickly it moved and how it was processed and shortened or different aspects were focused on. If there was a casualty from a certain city, then that city's newspapers would focus on that. All the stuff we're familiar with, but that was happening there, and he's writing about it in his diary. So you can connect up the, you can join the dots by researching these diary entries. So yeah, it's a great project. And I mean, in fact, that's what I'm working on at the moment, just writing an introduction and footnotes to these diaries. I'm hoping to get those out in the next year or so.
Another thing I liked that you did with him, with Hewitson, was you don't really focus upon this, but you do show how, as he continues his journalistic career, how he prospers. And I thought that was interesting in terms of what it said about what motivated people to do this, the very notion that it wasn't, we don't, and nowadays we oftentimes talk about journalism as a civic enterprise, but for these people, it was not just a living and a remunerative one, but it was one in which they could actually enjoy a degree of social uplift, that they could improve their status, and they go from being sort of this maybe working class person who, you know, gets into this as a career to they can, you know, be a small business owner and prosper and rise up to the ranks of the middle class.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there were lots of success stories like this Hewitson guy from Preston. Many of them, you know, went much further, and they went beyond the local to the national. And quite a lot of newspaper owners, Victorian newspaper owners, became MPs, members of parliament, politicians. And that was as people like Rupert Murdoch show. That's you know, the link between politics and the media is a very profitable link if you play it the right way. He started as an apprentice, which wasn't the lowest of the low. Your parents had to pay quite a substantial amount in a bond to the employer, you know, on the promise that you wouldn't get drunk and smash the machinery. so he's kind of sort of skilled working class craftsman. But yes, he moved up the social strata. And you can see he stopped worshipping in kind of nonconformist Methodist and Baptist chapels and Unitarian chapels, and goes over to the sort of established Church of England, which is where you probably network with wealthier people. And he sold his newspaper when he got to only about his mid-50s, but in the census he describes himself as a gentleman after that. So, yeah, he retired quite nicely. But I think he entered the market after the newspaper taxes were abolished at mid-century. It was a bit of a free-for-all. The market was in turmoil. People were trying out all sorts of things. You know, so will these working-class people actually buy newspapers? How much can we charge them? What do they want to read? And there are all sorts of creative experiments, most of which, you know, failed miserably. But the people that struck gold, could become very, very rich.
I was thinking the best example of that was in your chapter about the relationship between the Preston media and the development of association football. And I thought it was interesting in that respect, because nowadays it's sort of a given that sports is a very established and valued feature of it. I know so many people throughout my life who the first news they check is the sporting news. And yet, as you describe it, it was hardly a established phenomenon from the first. And you talk about it on two levels that I thought were really interesting. One was how, you know, the market was just developing this niche, which is now so huge, and how presses that people that tried to start, you know, sports specific presses don't really do very well. But also at the same time, how it gets tied into this notion of place and identity that you talk about as well.
Yeah, it was just a happy coincidence that organized sport, like with regular fixtures and leagues and championships, all that sort of infrastructure that makes sport regular and predictable as an event. You know, we know on Saturday there will be a football match, for example, or there will be a horse race at this place. All that infrastructure started being created just at the same time as the provincial press was taking off. And so much of sport, I mean, in England, it's that football game with the round ball that was the big thing then and still is now. Although other sports like rugby and cricket to a lesser extent, but there's this sort of almost tribal local patriotism, you know, the same as with them in the States as well, the connection between the local sports team and local identity. And that was an obvious connection with the local press, that here was something that made people proud of where they lived, that they wanted to read about it, they wanted to chew the fat about it, speculate, they wanted to gather those statistics that fans love. And you know, have those arguments about who scored the most or who got the most fouls against them. And the press was the perfect vehicle for expressing that and supplying that need. I think I mentioned that at the very small local level, when some people tried to have a sports only newspaper in a small town like Preston, the market wasn't big enough. In the bigger cities, that was sustainable. But then 10 years later, the market had changed. Football had become more popular, and there were now enough people to support that. So the sort of mainstream evening newspaper on a Saturday could have an extra purely sports edition late in the evening after the match had been played. And this weird thing that people had been to the match, they'd seen every goal, they knew what had happened, but they were the primary readership to buy the sports paper and then read what they already knew, that their team had won or lost and who'd made it, we'll win or lose. So it was a marriage made in heaven, really, between local sport and local media.
There's of course the flip side of that, which you explore, which I also thought was equally interesting, because it just never occurred to me, which is how, as this was taking off, it was also something that you could ignore. And that gets to Hewitson, who I thought had this very fascinating disdain for football. And tying back to that class rise and how he starts to think of himself as more of a gentleman, which occurred right around that time, and how you describe how he's actively refusing to cover football in his newspaper at a time when you would think that editors would be wanting to put whatever is in there that's going to sell papers. He has a very different attitude.
Yeah, I think he was a bit of a cantankerous old gent, especially when he got into middle age, and he just thought he knew better than the readers, and that's a very dangerous attitude in the media. He just thought it was a passing fad, and he disliked the gambling that was associated with it. So he thought, I'll give that one a miss. That one's not going anywhere. I won't waste my time on that. But unfortunately, his competitors in the local market thought differently and thought, well, this is working class readers like this. They're the people we're now trying to expand our market to. So we're going with it. Even whether they might be holding their noses and thinking, well, yes, I don't really approve either. But they were just a bit more commercially minded than Hewitson. But yeah, he hated it. And when he realized he'd missed the boat. He could look out of his office window and he could see the crowds in the street outside his competitors' offices, waiting for the scores and waiting for their detailed match reports that Hewitson had foolishly decided not to provide. Yeah, and my hunch is that, the market was changing them for all sorts of reasons, but one reason why I think his paper started to decline was he missed out on probably the biggest trend in local journalism from the 1880s onwards, which was football.
This actually ties very nicely into something that you were talking about earlier in the book, and also it's something that you're expanding upon in the final portion, which is this notion of how these papers reflected their communities. And you mentioned how some of these, like for example, the people that were buying these newspapers to see the football results were the players themselves. And I thought that was really interesting how you get into this issue of, or this consideration of how, people love to see their name in print, and how this is reflected not just in those people who purchased issues where they were in them and they already knew what the news was, but about how they would actively seek to get published. And I especially was struck by the compositor whose proudest moment was when he set the type for a letter that he himself had written for the newspaper that was going to be printed.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's what makes local media so special, really, today, and what seemed to be there in the Victorian age, that people basically want to see their lives reflected in the local media, and somehow it makes their lives seem more significant, and their little town or village or city somehow it's made immortal in some kind of way, the fact that it's been recorded in the local media. In Victorian times, it was in black and white in print. And yes, for people to see their own names, as photography was introduced, to see their own faces, And the traditional, you know, I went into journalism in the 1980s, but the thinking on local papers then was get as many names and as many faces into the paper. And that's how you sell papers. I mean, even today, whenever I go to any different place around Britain or anywhere really, I always buy a copy of the local newspaper. And some of these traditional papers are still using that same technique. And if you lived in that town and you opened the paper on a Thursday or a Saturday and there was no mention of you in it or your family, then you'd know that you died, really, because just everyone and their lives get covered somehow. And I think there's something magical in it. Somehow makes places and people almost like sacred. You know, it gives them this sort of magical glow if they are mentioned in the local press. And so, yes, people... I mean, there's a famous media theorist called James Carey who said people don't read newspapers to get new information. They read the newspaper in a ritual sort of way to have their worldview confirmed that I matter, my life matters, my kids' dancing show matters. You know, the history of this place where I've decided to spend my life matters. And this newspaper is telling me, yes, it's important. Here we are, we've written about it this week. And to me, that's what made it saleable, and that's what the editors realized. And they sold this stuff back to the readers. They reflected these lives back to the readers who lapped it up.
And that gets to where you're talking about how, you know, for how the way that these papers, you know, did that by mirroring their communities, in not just in terms of, okay, here are their faces, here are their names, but they're capturing their dialect, they're really,
yeah,
they really do, they don't, they really are, you know, embodiments of those, you know, as you described at the very beginning, these very distinct differences that exist over in a relatively limited space.
Yeah, so an editor or a publisher, they could apply a formula, and I tried to sort of spell out what that formula was, you know, almost like this is how to run a Victorian local newspaper. Not actually a very useful formula nowadays, but this is these are the techniques that they followed. And you might say, well, that's just, yeah, it's just generic stuff. That it is, it's just formulaic. But when, as you say, when you apply it to one town that has this type of dialect, then the formula produces different results than in the next town 10 miles away that has a different dialect, a different economy, different local references, different local metaphors, you know, that come from the cotton industry or that come from coal mining, different working hours, different working conditions, perhaps different trade union strengths. So that formula, yeah, produced sort of unique local results, even when it was, and yeah, outsiders sometimes did come in and just applied the formula very successfully and produced a locally distinctive newspaper that met the needs of those local readers.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Okay, so as I mentioned, these diaries of this local reporter and then later editor, Anthony Hewitson, there's 17 volumes of them in the local archives here. So with one of his ancestors, is that the right word? No, the other way around, one of his descendants, we've transcribed them all, and I'm now working through them and adding footnotes and researching the background to them, ready to publish them, both online in a searchable open access format, but also as a print book, because they are unique, and there's enough that's interesting beyond just the history of journalism, just about life in the 19th century and about his servant. He was always sacking servants. They were never quite right, as well as his sort of journalistic life and his family life. Mm-hmm. So that's the project at the moment.
Will you also be publishing that book with the Open Book Publishers?
I'm hoping so. They haven't given me an answer yet, but I'm hoping so. Yeah, they're an open access publisher, which means that you can download the whole of my book that we've been talking about for free. It's there on the Open Book Publishers website. Or if you want, you can get the Kindle edition for a bit of money, or the print edition for a bit of money. But it's this idea of, yeah, sort of making knowledge freely available So I'm hoping the diaries will be printed that way as well. For me, as an academic historian, I decided to go with them because in the hope that my book would be more widely read and more widely used, and it's, you know, it's be more influential in this field of history that I work in. And although I won't get any royalties from it, the royalties from academic publishing are notoriously bad anyway. So I thought, you know, what have I lost? And I thought there's more to gain from taking the open access route.
Well, I think that, you know, it was a great choice because it's a great resource. I was fortunate to have a printed edition, which was very nicely put together. But having that resource, I do hope that it helps to get your book the audience it deserves.
Thank you very much.
Andrew, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Mark. Okay. Thank you. Bye.